Excellence is about self-mastery. These are not my words. These are the words of my guest, Stefan K. Thieringer. Stefan is a business thinker, innovation strategist, and executive coach. His recent company, the Human Innovation Garage, is a leading coaching and advisory firm working at the critical intersection of talent and business. This is a special episode, as the topics discussed in this episode are much different from the previous episodes. In a rather extremely casual conversation, we discuss on several topics in depth. Some of the topics includes self-mastery, authenticity, what drives motivation, what are some of the traits of an entrepreneur, and so forth. Upcoming next is the highlights of the same conversation, followed by the entire conversation. I hope you're going to enjoy it.
And really what you want to say is, what the fuck did you do about it? You didn't do anything about it. Yeah. And that's kind of, I think the entrepreneur to me is, if we're really looking at the core of the entrepreneur, is somebody who has vision, somebody who can see something where there is an impact to be made. And it doesn't have to be new. It can be just simple innovation, right? And we make innovation. And, you know, the reason why I always say this is, how the entrepreneur, because I think there's something sexy about it to say, I'm an entrepreneur. And I think a lot of young people, they go study entrepreneurship. Well, what you're really learning is maybe the fundamentals of business, and hopefully you got to read as an entrepreneur is Start With Why, a book by Simon Sinek. Sure, you've read it. Sure, you're familiar with it.
No, I've not.
It's a wonderful book about what their value system is, because when you think about what authenticity is, and oftentimes conformity is the enemy of excellence, because excellence is not about, you know, competition. Excellence is not about external factors. Excellence is about driving yourself to be better today than you were yesterday. This is not about anybody else. Excellence is about self-mastery and continuously doing better and challenging yourself to be better. And it's not about, again, motivation. It's about discipline and following through with that. Can we talk for 5 minutes? Can you close the door? Can you sit down? I want to share something with you. That will completely fuck up their entire day. But that will completely, really, really fuck up their entire day. Yeah. Exploring to innovate and innovate around culture. And if we like it or not, innovation around culture needs to happen and can't happen in a silo. And it more than anything in a context of culture, it needs to happen from the top of the organization. If there is no buy-in from a C-level sponsor to innovate around culture in an organization, it's like a spin-off in an organization in an innovation lab where somebody has a great idea, they tinker around with it for 3 months, and then somebody, because it doesn't pass the innovation gate number one and it doesn't comply with certain requirements, where a project manager says, yeah, yes, 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 no, 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 not, sorry, three things not cleared in the gate, we're gonna send it back. We'll-
Looking back, you know, like, you know, this 30 years, how do you see yourself now, you know, looking back and now what you're doing now? Did you ever imagine, like, you know, the things that you're doing now, perhaps you would have thought, you know, 30 years back?
You know, I think that's where people, now we get into mindset and all the emotions we're creating for ourselves, let them be real or not, and the fears and the anxieties. So I think, you know, for me, people has always been the beacon. I always enjoyed people when I was young. I was very social and I was very in the neighborhood. We had a great group of kids. We were engaged, and it was always like I was the social connector. And part of it came always from, my father was a politician and my mother in general was just a very outgoing, very likable, social person. And I think then at some point this kind of split, right? And the split is this: my father being a politician, I learned to image management and to image manage, like, this is what we got to look like on the outside of the world, and this is how we need to pretend or protect or whatever it may be. And then my mother was much more like, you know what? I don't like it, I will tell you. I like it, I will tell you. I'm going to do what I want. And I remember my father and my mother getting into argument about it. And I think the reason why this is important for me is I look at it back now to your question. And I think the people theme was very consistent for me, which is why I came here in the United States, to the United States in 1991. And I came for hospitality, and there was people, right? It was about creating experiences for people. And my father wanted me, so my brother is 8 years younger, and he's a Doogie Howser, a world-class gastroenterologist at the University Clinic in Mainz in Germany. And so I always was a little bit the rebel, more like my mother, mm-hmm. and ended up in a business in hospitality. And then later when I left hospitality, go into entrepreneurship, where whatever we want to say entrepreneurship is. I mean, I can't stand when I see young people tell me, oh, I'm an entrepreneur. Well, just tell me what it is that you do. What does your business do? It's not this cachet of I'm an entrepreneur. Well, what does that mean? And so I went to the deep end of that by building one of the first LMS companies in the late 90s, which was ASP based at that point. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of things where I look back and I recognize the choices I made at that time, even though I wasn't conscientious of that. Mm-hmm. I was actually making a choice. And these milliseconds of decisions, they can change your life. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the only thing I take with it. And there have been moments where I decided I'm going to come to the US. Well, that was like a heartbeat second decision of about 5 minutes. My life could be totally different. I regret not spending more time in Europe. Okay, do I say this with regret? No, because I mean, I still have, knock on wood, hopefully enough time to, you know, spend more time in Europe. But I think these are the kinds of things where I look back at and I don't look at it. It's funny, somebody asked me last week, do you have any regrets? Would you do anything different? And I honestly don't, because I believe firmly the human being I am today and what I'm able to offer, to pay forward, to provide context and content on, mm-hmm. is very much grounded in all the experiences and the roller coasters and the tribulations that I've experienced.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned one of the things that I'm very curious about is entrepreneurship, and you touched that subject, and you mentioned, like, you know, you asked the entrepreneur, so what do you do, right? And now I'm going to just do the same thing to you, like, what exactly do you do, right? What exactly do you do? And for you, you know, I want to follow up that with asking you, like, who is an entrepreneur for you?
Yeah. So I think, so let me answer the first question first. So I work at the intersection of talent and business strategy, and we partner with organizations who are looking to inspire culture within organizations and really looking to optimize skill and talent in the context of business strategy within organizations. So here's what that means in simplistic terms. If you are, and we've all been in environments where we may or may have not felt recognized and acknowledged for the talent and the skill we have, but at the same time, for reasons of conformity or reasons of the need to survive, which translates oftentimes into I need to earn an income, have put ourselves in positions where we do things half-heartedly, or maybe we realize we're really not that good at it, but we need to do it because we need to earn money. Mm-hmm. I partner with companies to identify people and help people identify where their strengths and weaknesses are, and in a vulnerable and open, kind manner, engage into a dialogue that allows now people to be open about it. Like, so we work with a company as a global partner where we do psychometric analysis, behavioral assessments, as well cognitive assessments. One is more focused on just who you are as an individual, and the other one is focused on what is the job role you've taken on, and is your natural skill set and talent set really suited to execute on that job well? Mm-hmm. And if you take those two pieces in context, that's really where my work starts. Because again, I think there's a lot of companies who are very focused on results, on goals. But what they keep forgetting is that there's a people engine in the middle that drives that. And empathy, recognition, care, relatability to individuals is probably, after the last year we've seen with COVID, more important than ever. So that's where I spent my time, and that's what the Human Innovation Garage does.
Mm-hmm. And how would the your own definition of entrepreneur, like, how do you...
You know, I think in German we say Unternehmer. That could be anything from small to very large, right? And you'll find it for people who have a single one-man show, one-woman show business, all the way to, for that matter, large corporations. I mean, I always laugh. I know a bunch of guys over here at TripAdvisor, and TripAdvisor still today calls themselves a startup company.
Really?
We're startup, okay. But they're far beyond the startup, what we traditionally refer to as startup. But who's to say that a startup can't be a multi-hundred-million-dollar company? Mm-hmm. So I think that's where we build cliches around the terminology. The reason why I think entrepreneur to me is an important definition is this. I think entrepreneur says to me, you are self-driven, you are at the helmet, you are the thinker, you're the visioner, and you are the person who is ultimately... particularly in the early stages of an organization, you're the one who is bound with executing or not. And I think one thing is motivation and the other thing is discipline. I think one requirement that when I look at an entrepreneur, I seek is, does this individual have the discipline to execute? Because we can be motivated all day. If you don't get out of bed to be motivated to get onto your bike or you're running or working out or meditating or to work or whatever it may be, well, all that good motivation is wonderful, but if you don't have the discipline to ultimately follow through, well, then there's nothing, right? Entrepreneurship is, in the end, 1-2% of the idea and 98% is execution. Because we've all been in situations where we sit at the dinner table with people and they say, oh, I thought about that 10 years ago.
Or the learnings that you do with the leaders or maybe the people that you're within the organizations. And what are some of the variables that you can think of that you can really say, okay, these are some of the variables that are going to determine if the person is not interested in what he or she are doing, and they might be better suited off doing something else. What do you look for there?
You know, I think it's multiple factors. I think it's I think one of the things which is one of the greatest books everybody should have read as an entrepreneur is Start With Why, mm-hmm. a book by Simon Sinek. Sure, you've read it. Sure, you're familiar with it.
No, I've not.
It's a wonderful book, and you should take a look at it. And I do believe that what is your why and what is the emotional connection that you can find to your own business, but also what is the emotional connection that you can find to me as somebody who is conducting the business that allows you to feel invited to trust, to connect, to inquire further, because ultimately we like to do business with people who we like, and we like to do business with people who we somehow find relation to. Mm-hmm. I think that's the first piece. The question you asked me, really, if I'm, you know, working with someone who is, let's say, looking to transform and has identified patterns that don't serve him or her anymore and going forward, and they've recognized that, let's say, they've hired as a chairman of a company the second or third president, and every 6 months to 9 months that individual quits on them, mm-hmm. because they for one reason or another they don't stay. Mm-hmm. Well, the first person quitting, maybe that's about them. The second person quitting is now interesting. The third person quitting within 2 years, and I'm speaking from an example, mm-hmm. The third person quitting within 2 years, well, now we're looking at a pattern. Now there is something in the environment of the organization that is restricting their commitment in staying with the organization. I think the first thing I always look for is the authenticity of an individual. How true are they to their own value system, and how in tune are they actually with their value system is? Because when you think about what authenticity is the combination between values and between the actions I'm taking. And that ultimately is authenticity. So the way I get to experience you is not by you talking about something. The way I get to experience you is by you declaring or you acting in a certain way, which then allows me to kind of see interesting, based on the way he acted, his value system, or that must be a value to him or not, or whichever way, you know, that in the context of a dialogue or a conversation or a transaction for that matter, transpires. And I think that's the first piece I'm looking for when I work with someone, if that's an individual or a group. How true and how aware are they actually of their value systems? And how clear are they? How are they being perceived by other people? And are they willing to A, shift that? And are they willing to connect with people at a level that allows people to authentically feel and see them and have essentially an empathetic relationship? And that goes both ways. So if somebody is faking it, that comes out very, very quickly. And oftentimes, you know, when you in a workshop environment, that's what you talked about, you will find people in there who are there because they were told to be there.
Yeah.
And that also, those people very quickly self-identify as, you know, I'm here because I have to, or, and we have had situations where I said, you know, particular individuals, I don't think that makes any sense to work with them. And I'm very careful these days, particularly on my one-to-one coaching, who I work with, and I'm pretty selective in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, I see within the context of organizations, especially whenever there is a new initiative around change, you know, especially to do with the change, when there is a transformative initiative going on, you'd find people, let's say, not, let's say, willingly participated in that change process, right? And perhaps, you know, your workshop perhaps would be a very good starting point there. I don't know. Maybe you can see it in a different way.
You know, I think you're correct, but I think you also need to understand, you know, organizations seek change and individuals seek change usually in a moment of truth. And let me qualify that moment of truth. If you're an executive who is being told, and those situations happen every day, that you need to get some coaching or you need to get some, you need to attend a workshop, it's usually factor of motivation that's external. That's not you saying, oh, I need that necessarily, because somebody tells you to do that. Because at that moment, what happens for you oftentimes is you experience threat. Mm-hmm. And as human beings, you know, we go to the core needs of us, which is shelter and food and survival for that matter in this context. And what happens is now we feel ourselves threatened because we may lose our livelihood if we don't do. Mm-hmm. And that becomes the motivating factor. And for some people that becomes very clear to themselves, and some people may not see it that clear, but that's the reason why they conform. And oftentimes conformity is the enemy of excellence. Mm-hmm. Because excellence is not about, you know, competition. Excellence is not about external factors. Excellence is about driving yourself to be better today than you were yesterday. This is not about anybody else. Excellence is about self-mastery. And continuously doing better and challenging yourself to be better. And it's not about, again, motivation. It's about discipline and following through with that. And that same thing is a requirement. If you want to really, you know, have transformation happen for you, you need to look at that the same way. It's kind of, if you've ever been to a therapist, you don't go to the therapist because somebody else tells you to. If you've, you know, if anybody has ever gone to marriage therapy, or marriage counseling, well, if your wife or your partner tells you, oh, we got to go to counseling, and you go because your partner tells you, well, you're just going to sit there and you go, okay, okay. And then you leave and you kind of, you know, you check the box and you say, okay, done.
I've done that.
Yeah. So, and then comes the moment where you suddenly realize, holy shit, I really need to work on myself. Mm-hmm. Because I'm repeating the same pattern in the relationship again. Well, I'm, which is what I referred to earlier as patterns. Mm-hmm. And that's the moment of brilliance and beauty where now intervention is possible, right? And I don't mean this in a sense of addiction. I mean this in a sense of, wow, now I can do something about it. Now I can really re-engineer myself, which is, you know, part of the wordplay, Human Innovation Garage, as we call our company, mm-hmm. is because there's humans, there's a lot of innovation you can do because we all have inherent brilliant pieces, but maybe we need a little more structure, a little bit more support and tools that help us remind ourselves, okay, here is what we need to do in order to compound the interest that we're paying in self-improvement every day, which over your period of time, you know, bears wonderful fruit of changing certain behaviors and certain patterns or moments that we get triggered and we react rather than making a conscious choice of an action. Mm-hmm. Is that helpful?
Yeah. I mean, then, you know, when you look at the organization, in that perspective, like you said, maybe there are symptoms, you know, maybe there are patterns that we need to look for within the organization. Maybe their culture itself is diluted or is more, you know, let's say not a very open culture within the organization. And that stops from people from innovating, right? So people within the context of an organization, they don't innovate because they are not allowed to do so. So how do you deal with those sort of organizations where there are those challenges exist?
You know, I think organizations, I mean, if we think about innovation in general and what it requires people to be creative and be innovators, I think there needs to be freedom, and there needs to be freedom for innovation and creativity. And creativity needs space, and it needs to be going. I mean, we're kind of going back to where we started, right? That if you're an innovator and I start micromanaging you and you're somebody who's creative, I am crushing your soul. Mm-hmm. And that's just the fact. And I think the other piece being, if somebody is a particular creative person, most of the times they're not somebody who is a good salesperson, or they're most of the times they're not somebody who is particularly focused on production. And these are the things that I need to have if I'm an organization. And regardless if I bring somebody in from the external side or if I'm doing it in-house, I need to be willing to almost be curious about that individual in the context of what it is that I want this individual to do and what is that individual most suited to do in the organization, which is why a lot of what we do is we really do process engineering and business thinking in organizations. Mm-hmm. Because if you tomorrow start working for Lego or for BMW or for Porsche or for Mercedes or for Siemens or for Logitech or whoever it is, mm-hmm. that company, we already know what the product is they're making, right? If you start tomorrow working for Mercedes, well, that company is known for producing cars. Mm-hmm. They're not going to change making cars. If you are not interested in making cars or working at a company that you can somewhat identify with and getting excited about that company makes cars, well, maybe you shouldn't work there. But let's just hypothetically say you're the guy who's more about making gummy bears and you want to work for Haribo. Well, then that's a totally different story. But so we've now identified you that you enjoy working for, you know, food and beverage companies. Well, that's a very different driver than it is working for a company which makes cars. Mm-hmm. So the question then is, why are you where you're at as somebody who enjoys making gummy bears or in a company which makes food and beverage? And that's the first question always. I think it goes back to then, or not, I think, I know it goes back to, again, your value system. Are you working there because you need to make a living, or are you working there because that's the only job you could get? Or are you working there because ultimately it aligns with your value system because you want to work in a company that makes a difference to people in creating enjoyable foods? Mm-hmm. And I'm oversimplifying here. I mean, it's not that easy because, I mean, every manufacturing company like the size of a Haribo, the excitement of making gummy bears is not as much as being a pastry chef in a French pastry shop or making chocolate in Belgium, which is where you're located, and you have this little craft store at the corner. But let's take that little craft store at the corner, right? Let's take that chocolatier who is absolutely brilliant, and he or she is, that's their life's work. They've all their life worked with chocolate. They like the artistry. They like everything from the texture to the flavor to the variety it exists, the commitment to fair trade, where they're sourcing the chocolate from, where all the way to where they want to sell it to, and the price control, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the things we can think about. Mm-hmm. Well, that person can be in a chocolate in a pâtisserie or a chocolatier. That there's somebody who's really, really good at maybe one part of the production. Well, let's find out who that is, because that person probably is not very concerned or very good at being at the register and selling it. We need to find someone else, because creative people oftentimes they're not necessarily very outgoing. They're tinkerers.
Mm-hmm.
They like to discover. They need moments by themselves. They need, I don't want to say privacy, but they need time to just do without somebody jumping over their shoulder. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of creating environments and providing and protecting environments for people where we know that this is how they operate best. But that happens, and that discovery needs to happen in a dialogue. So that dialogue needs to happen, and there needs to be some structure to that dialogue. There needs to be some questions asked. There needs to be discovery. There needs to be an understanding of how is this person thinking about certain things, right? If I say to you, let's take, for example, if I say to you skiing, what's the first thing that comes to mind for you?
Austria, maybe.
There you go. So there's certain associations you make in your instance with countrysides.
Yeah.
Like funny enough, the first thing for me is when you talk to me about skiing, the first thing that comes to mind for me is Kitzbühel, Austria.
Yeah.
Right? That's the first thing.
Yeah.
I basically grew up there, right? Yeah. But for other people, they may say, well, the first thing is a pair of skis. Or somebody else may say, oh, the first thing for me is, oh my God. And now we come to mindset. Oh my God, it's like crazy. When I take my three kids skiing, it costs me a fortune. It's making me crazy. So the perspective of someone, how they look at things, is very, very important. And it's equally important in the context of people management, because that speaks oftentimes to their experience, their trauma, their upbringing, their environment, their education, their emotional stage, all these various factors, which now, when we do good coaching, we do good discovery, we do good, you know, collaboration and co-creation with people, we want to understand that because we want to give you an environment that supports you, that serves you, that makes you flourish and doesn't crush you down.
I see from a lot of organizations, you know, especially within the larger context, right, to bigger organizations, I see transformations, initiative on a regular basis. And then I see the transformation is happening on a more of a, let's say, a bubble, right? So within a bubble, there are teams and they are working within that, bubble. As soon as the bubble bursts, the transformation also stops, right? So is that a challenge within the organization? Do you see this pattern, like wherever you go, or...
You know, I'm laughing. Well, because, you know, it's interesting. So it's actually not a bad thing. So I think innovation, because if we think about innovation in general, and we think about any process of innovation, and we think about the innovation process or process innovation, there are in any corporation and any company or anybody who's ever run a company, and that includes myself, you start thinking of innovation also of the main goal in organizations for innovation is really increase of revenue and market share. That's what innovation is mostly about. It's commercialization of something. Mm-hmm. And it's always thought of in large corporations in the context of commercialization. And let's be clear, that's why, you know, business is in business, because you asked me earlier, what's an entrepreneur? Well, an entrepreneur said, oh, my business is, well, do you have a business or is it an idea? Do you have revenues and what's your net? And so I think we got to qualify that a little bit too when we talk about business. But let's take the business that is a mature business and they're exploring to innovate and innovate around culture. And if we like it or not, innovation around culture needs to happen and can't happen in a silo. And it more than anything in a context of culture, it needs to happen from the top of the organization. If there is no buy-in from a C-level sponsor to innovate around culture in an organization, it's like a spin-off in an organization in an innovation lab where somebody has a great idea, they tinker around with it for 3 months, and then somebody, because it doesn't pass the innovation gate number one and it doesn't comply with certain requirements where a project manager says, yeah, yes, 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 no, sorry, three things not cleared in the gate, we're going to send it back. Will never happen. And it could have been the greatest, most brilliant idea ever, but because it didn't clear the gate of a project manager to the restrictive parameters that they've implemented before, well, it never goes into production or never into even research with the market to see if there is any kind of viability in the market and reception. With culture, it's very, very similar, but it's even more extreme because it's so much more the sensibility of the subject and how easy it can break is needs to be so carefully handled. Mm-hmm. And if there is no buy-in and there is no consistency, there's no clarity around, think of it like your parents, right? If your parents, the way you grew up, you ask your father or your mother for the car. I mean, we've all been in Europe, I don't know, in Belgium, I don't remember, but we started driving in Germany at the age of 18. Mm-hmm. And so when I would ask my father or my mother, can I get the car this weekend? The answer was the same. I mean, I was lucky I had a car at 18, but there's a lot of kids who ask their parents on Saturday, and, hey, I'm taking six of my friends on and I want to go get the car. Mm-hmm. And dad will say no. And then the same kid goes to mom and says, hey, mom, can I get your car? And some moms will say, what did dad say? And some moms will say, oh, just take my car. Dad doesn't need to know. Just take it. Just be careful. Mm-hmm. Boom.
Yeah.
Right. So what's the communication here? The communication here is that the value system is really not aligned in this organization. And that happens exactly in organization. So if dad's the CEO, but somehow there's a workaround, or mom's the CEO and dad's the department manager, and the CEO says, ah, don't worry about it. Just do whatever you want. We don't care if we're honest. We're just going to charge whatever. Well, you know what? That speaks to integrity. That speaks to all the values that we want in a culture where people also feel comfortable. Because one of the basic needs, again, what people need is clarity. They need safety. And they need trust in order to operate and function well. Because if I don't have that, I'm not going to tell you how I feel. I'm not going to tell you what's going on for me. I'm not going to believe that you actually care about it. And needing to matter, right? Because in the core, we're all little kids. Needing to matter in an organization, not because I do great work, but just because I need acknowledgement. That feeds me. That's natural. That's something some people need more of and some people need less of. That's an important factor. So again, you know, top to bottom alignment needs to be there. There needs to be an executive sponsor in the organization who says, you know what, we're really after a cultural revolution. Here's the value set that we're aligning to. The core values of the organization are truth, integrity, connection, care, whatever other words that particular organization may add to that. But then again, the authentic connection of the organization to that is by showing it through action. And the action starts at the employee level, any level, if that is, you know, a senior vice president, if that is an executive VP, if that's a C-level executive in the C-suite, and it goes all the way, not to, you know, re-emphasize hierarchy top to bottom, but it does go all the way to the level of the newest employee, who's the newest addition, who needs to experience that care, transparency, empathy in an onboarding session with human resources. And I think that's sometimes where, again, we get very, very tactical, we get very, very matter of fact, and we're forgetting that behind everything we do in an organization and what ultimately gives us, you know, the success is not necessarily the process, it's really the individual who's executing on the guideline of the process.
So you touched on the culture part, you know, a couple of times. I want to sort of, you know, ask you a little bit, you know, what kind of culture do you want to see in an organization where, at least on the C level, they say we want to innovate, and you sort of, you know, go into the organization and, like, you know, you sort of, you know, get a first-hand experience of the actual culture within the organization. Where, how do you even begin? Like, you know, if that is not suited to innovate, and if you see that these are some of the variables that are a big no-no, so where do you even start in those organizations?
So I think the first touch point is the individual that let's create any kind of a scenario. There's an individual who reaches out and we start, you know, dialoguing. Where we oftentimes start is kind of what we call an executive alignment and an executive, let's call it, for the sake of the discussion, a survey.
Yeah.
Where we really look at something where our first step of entry into an organization is what we call an executive briefing. Mm-hmm. And the result of executive briefing is really are how many executives it may be, are they all aligned in the direction of the company, in the organization, in the structure? Are they aware and are they communicating and willing to communicate in this dialogue through initially a kind of a digital survey, even sometimes will be used, that there are discrepancy, differences, misalignments within the executive suite, and what are they? And oftentimes that comes out, one guy will say, you know, we're an elephant, we're a horse, we're a cow, we're a dog, we're a cat. And there is not one organization that I haven't walked into or have walked into that there was not some of that very transparent. Mm-hmm. And in the executive briefing then, where we usually spend with an executive team anywhere between, you know, 90 minutes to 2 hours, what happens there is that dialogue is being brought up and it becomes an open dialogue around how self-aware, it's all about awareness, if that's on an individual or even on a team level. How aware is this team actually that there are some misalignments, if that's on the value system side, if that's on the mission side of the organization, if that's on the you know, state of affairs where we're at today, what are some of the critical components that organization needs support in, etc., etc. And that becomes the starting point. And then usually once there is reception there in the context of the executive briefing, which says, oh, interesting, we never really thought about it this way. So a lot of what we talked about, alignment, business process, cultural impact, inspiration, creativity, innovation levels, who does innovation at the organization? What is kind of the permission-based management structure in an organization? Meaning, what do you do on own authority / empowerment / motivation / following through with discipline versus are you waiting for people to tell you? Is there a micromanagement culture? Is there a helicopter management? Is there within the culture is openness about vulnerability? I mean, today more than ever, we talk about what I call life. We used to talk about life work balance, right? I no longer talk about life work balance. I talk about life work integration. Mm-hmm. Because there is no balance anymore. It's like life is happening on the lap of your home office. And it's just so disruptive, destructive. The support people need in order to experience cohesiveness in remote teams is more required than ever before, et cetera, et cetera. So once we get through that session, that's when we start really proposing what we, and in the body of my work, what we've created is called an corporate and an company optimization blueprint. And that really deals with everything that you alluded to. It deals with an assessment, which allows us to really support some of the things we instinctually already, or I instinctually already know, from a leadership structure in terms of who the individuals are. We start looking at team dynamics of who they are. Are these people who are more, you know, analysts who like to be individualists, who drive sales on their individual basis, or are they more collaborators? Are they more from a strategy standpoint, integrators of other people? Are they more on the captain side, where they go to a point of, you know, they may be highly social, but very, very driven, very type A, fairly independent, but at times needs, they may be compliant with corporate policies to not shake the boat too much, but nevertheless challenge some of the traditionalism. And we take that then to really start getting to the next phase of what does the company need to be engineered as in the context of the people resources to really support whatever values there are. And sometimes what we find is, you may find, I mean, I just literally earlier today had a conversation like that. You may find companies where there's two co-founders, one, and they're, this particular company is in the fashion and design business. And you may have one person, you know, who's the maker, who's the tinkerer, who just wants everything to be like, you know, a certain way and perfect. And the other one is more the manager, someone who is much more after the results driven outcome of the business. Doesn't mean he or she doesn't care about the business and what the mission of the business is, but the roles they play within the organization are very, very different. So what do they bring into that now? So I talk a lot about executive trauma. And executive trauma is kind of the way in you may have experienced things in the past. So what do we bring forward? So if I've worked for an organization which is a hospitality organization before, so more than likely I'm somebody who wants people to have, you know, a wow customer experience. I want to be high touch. I want to be accommodating. I want to have a people experience. Well, if there's somebody on the other side who is coming out of, a consulting company who is highly, highly analytic, focused on numbers and KPIs and simple performance, and the only time you count is when you bill time in hours. Well, that's a totally different approach. Totally different approach. So how do we make those two parts communicate with each other? But also, how do we initially create awareness for you that this is what you're doing, right? Because that's where really also then coaching comes in. And coaching is not always pretty, because coaching sometimes is really ugly, because you get to face yourself. Mm-hmm. And that happens through being asked the right question or being described a scenario, as I just described to you, where some people then go, oh, wow, interesting. That's actually me.
Yeah.
Well, now let's talk about that. And body language and eye movement and all kinds of different things are great indicators then, how you can tell that somebody you just hit on the spot. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think, it's so tough these days, because there's coaches at every corner. I always say this, a great coach has two things, three things: great gut feeling, great training, but also the ability to take risk in stepping over the edge at the risk of losing the client, because that's when the greatest moments of pivoting in terms of change of behavior happen.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that you mentioned, during the, let's say, this self-awareness, you create the self-awareness, and even though people are aware, certain times they are reluctant to let go certain things, right? During the, a conversation which is more of a thought-provoking sort of, conversation. Yeah. What would be your approach, in those scenarios where you got to know as a coach, this guy is not letting go. And then, what are some of the things that you can, approach? I mean, as an approach, what are the things that you can do in order to lead a person from being reluctant to someone who can let go and then be that example to the company?
So, it's hard to always do this in generic examples. So,
yeah.
But let me give you a couple of tips here. I guess the first thing is, coaching is all about a good inquiry-based dialogue, right? Mm-hmm. It's all about asking the right questions and guiding a dialogue in a direction that where you feel you bring that person closer to where they can ultimately see what their actions are and kind of reflect back on that. I think the other part, which is always very helpful, is always to move away from the individuals and kind of bring it generic and describe almost like a case study, an mm-hmm. example that becomes relatable to them, where they then suddenly at some point in the story that you tell, they suddenly find themselves and interject and they go, oh, interesting, that's actually me. So you got to create some relatability and some relatable story, which is fact-based, but it's kind of like when you see these movies on TV, it not based on a true story, but it really is. But we've replaced all the original names with the actors. And so that's a little bit a part of that.
Yeah.
And what that directly then also goes to is what in the world of coaching, and some coaches use it and some coaches not so much, and some coaches use it, they're not even aware of it, which is called neuro-linguistic programming, which ultimately is a shift of perspective, which ultimately is reframing a story that you may be holding on to. And this is, I think, the question, we have to ask here. Well, they're not letting go. We got to find out what they're not letting go of. Are they not letting go because they just don't want to let go? Okay, great. But why do they not want to let go? Is there a traumatic experience behind it? Does it ground back into, they feel if they let go, they don't matter. They don't feel respected. And it's easy to say, oh, let go because you need to respect your employees. Well, that's great. That's only one half of the equation. Mm-hmm. Because there's a reason why I may be fighting you as an executive, as my coach, to say, I don't want to let go. Well, and I may be nervous to say to you, you know what, if I let this management style go, I feel that they're better than I am. I feel they know more than me. I feel that they're younger. I feel that they went to a better school than I did. Oh my God, I never had the knowledge they have. They're so brilliant. Okay, so let's change the story then. Let's change the perspective. Let's look at how can you share experiences, but also how can you become their mentor, and how can you really, in a complementary fashion, not feel threatened and switch it from a threat to actually a compliment. You know what? They've actually chosen to work here because they respect you. They've seen the work you've done. Yeah, that was 10 years ago when you got all these accolades and acclaims. That doesn't mean that it's not relevant to them. They still can have the respect in that. Yeah. But think of it that way. And sometimes little shifts like that, it's almost like this thing, oh, well, actually, you know what? I never really thought about it this way. Interesting. Mm. Okay. So it becomes this explorative stage where little seeds make people think, which is why it's important. You know, coaching has, and I don't want to entirely compare it with it, but TED Talks, there's a reason why TED Talks are 18 minutes, mm-hmm. right? Because there's an attention span, mm-hmm. which is about 15 to 20 minutes, then somebody turns off. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's scientifically proven. Coaching can be the same thing. You can have a conversation with somebody for, let's say you have a 60-minute coaching session. You can have a conversation with somebody for 45 minutes about something. They describe what's going on. You have mm-hmm. a conversation, you have a dialogue. And the last 5 minutes, 10 minutes, it just goes.
Yeah.
And that magic happens. And you realize as a coach, you go, wow, it took us 45 minutes to get here. But this piece, this nugget, that seed we just planted mm-hmm. is so significant and big. Now it's going to start growing. And when they come back the next time, they go, oh my God, you know what we talked about last time? I said, I know exactly what we talked about last time. But you said at the end, I said, I know exactly what you mean. I saw it in your face. I saw it in your body language. What happened? Tell me about it. Mm-hmm. Right? That's these moments which are pure magic. And that's, you know, if you can move your client or you can move individuals in an organization to exactly that, let's call it a pivot point, mm-hmm. where they start to be self-aware, self-reflect, and be willing to, I mean, it goes back to basics of emotional intelligence, right? That square, there's self-management and then there's the external. Self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, and relationship management. Mm-hmm. And the social awareness part comes directly based on, well, if I do that, or if I don't do that, or if I choose to do, or if I choose not to do, well, how do I affect the people around me or that one person around me? And that becomes, you know, a smart leadership pattern and a smart leadership matrix where I can say, okay, this is how I affect the people around me, but also understanding what's your story behind it. Because we all have our story, right? That's a big part of shifting perspective. We all have certain things framed in certain ways. Like there's people who walk into a conference room every single day and in their own minds, they go, you know what, when I walk into this conference room, people don't really like me and I really don't have much to say. And they want me to be there, but I really don't want to speak. There's a million people who right this second walk into a virtual or a real conference room and think that.
Yeah.
How do we help these people? How do we help people to really stand in their power? How do we help people to shift that to, you know, a value-based contribution rather than being tolerated and being in the room because they have to? Mm-hmm.
That's a day in and day out sort of scenario that I see, you know, even in my profession. And, you know, it's like, you know, I see people, you know, they're there, they don't have any opinion, or even they have an opinion, you know, which is half-hearted sort of opinion. You know, it's like you're forcing someone to provide an opinion and they're giving you, right? So it's like, oh, is it, how was your weekend? Yeah, it's good. You know, so that's it, right? You don't see more reaction from the person, right? So,
you know, my favorite is, and I always joke about this, my favorite is when, you know, you imagine this long hallway in an organization.
Yeah.
And there's the guy who's the CEO, the divisional manager, whatever, who she or he is, walks down the hallway and all the doors are open. And they kind of stick their head quickly in and lean onto the desk of the guy who's working in there or the girl. And they go, hey, how you doing? You doing all right? Good, great. And that's their... Right? I know why you're laughing, because it's like there's no connection. It's nothing. It's the alibi of, oh, you know, I say hello to my guys every single day. And you know what I always love to say in meetings when I talk to groups of people? I always say, you know what I want you to do the next time that happens to you? I want you to say, no, I'm not okay. Mm-hmm. Can we talk for 5 minutes? Can you close the door? Can you sit down? I want to share something with you. that will completely fuck up their entire day. Sorry for the word here. You're more than welcome to keep it in there, but but that will completely, really, really fuck up their entire day.
Yeah.
Because that's going to be, oh my God, my pattern of how I do things just got completely disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We think about neuroscientific behavior, we think about pattern interruption. Well, nothing better than that. Because that's ultimately what we're after. Let's change the way we operate in terms of disruptive patterns so we can start putting new patterns in place. But in order for that to happen, we need to be challenged on that. And that's like my favorite example all the time. It's like, you knew exactly, I saw you laughing. You knew exactly where I was going with that. So I think that's, you know, that's one of those pieces.
Yeah, yeah. And what I mean, if you look at your profession or also the offerings that you provide, and in your experience, what is more challenging for you, you know, within your profession or maybe talking to people or maybe, you know, dealing with a different mindset? What is the most challenging thing that you have to deal with?
Wow, loaded question.
It's a mixture of everything.
Yeah. So let me say out front. I always loved people, and I always loved making a difference for individuals and for groups of people, and seeing them transform or seeing them make an impact that was potentially catalyzed by what I said, what I did, that they were part of a team I was part of, and they went on to do their own thing or continue doing it with my team. How small or how large those teams were. But the thing I still today oftentimes, not oftentimes, but I sometimes get challenged is this, and this is going to sound very ridiculous, and it's going to sound very like particular. Mm-hmm. But there's moments when I have a dialogue with someone who is a CEO and a person of influence and power that I can feel that I get triggered, and I have to make a very conscious decision not to respond to that trigger. Where I need to suddenly kind of prove how much I know, or I need to kind of quote all my credentials, or I need to play a power game with somebody because it's my insecurity which triggers me. And I mean, not often, but I do find myself in these situations where I feel ignored. I feel rejected because I don't get a return call from somebody that I've spoken to. And instead of taking it personal, I gotta, you know, kind of go internal and say, you know what, they have other options besides working with me, or they have other options besides working with our company. That's just the market. That's just part of the process of sale and natural rejection for any reasons. Am I always interested in a post-reflection where we look at why did we lose a sale or why did we not continue in the conversation and the dialogue? Yes. But there's a healthy way to do it, and then there's the unhealthy way to do it. Mm-hmm. And I know today from my own awareness and self-awareness that if I go to, I'm not good enough, and as guys, we tend to do that a lot and very quickly. I'm not good enough, we're not big enough, we're not rich enough, we're not this enough as guys. We translate those kinds of behaviors very, very quickly also into business. And into the behavior we bring into business. And I think whenever I catch myself going in that direction, to your question, that's when I know I need to do some grounding, and I need to potentially, you know, get up from my desk and walk away and do a pattern interruption and talk about something else with someone else, or, you know, make a cup of espresso for myself, or whatever. Because it's really something. I mean, pattern interruption, as simple as you at a desk and you get up and you change your environment, can be so important and so powerful. We don't use it enough, and we're not aware enough of using it. But it can change, you know, it can change everything in the moment.
Mm. Yeah, because I'm sure in your profession, because you talk to a lot of CEOs and all the leadership, because they have choices, right? They have choices, and also sometimes you end up in a conversation which otherwise becomes a rabbit hole sort of conversation, right? And I'm thinking about those scenarios where perhaps sometimes you may feel challenged, right? So I'm sort of, you know, leaning more on towards those discussions, you know, where you know, you feel like, okay, shit, you know, I shouldn't have started this, you know.
No. See, I think that's, you know, I know exactly the conversations you're alluding to, but, you know, I find immense, and maybe this is why I'm doing what I'm doing or why I'm good at what I do. I find immense curiosity about this. And I find immense curiosity because of that I'm able to now say, okay, I'm getting triggered, but there's a reason why that individual is behaving that they're behaving. And that makes me even more curious. And so that rabbit hole actually for me becomes a rabbit hole of great interest and curiosity, which most of the times actually ends up very positive. Because again, I said earlier, you know, you can have a conversation with somebody for 45 minutes and suddenly something happens, something opens up. Mm-hmm. Have you, I mean, that's probably a silly question to ask you. You've been to the Taj Mahal, right?
Yes. Yes.
So when you come down that old road to the Taj Mahal, as you are being dropped off in its last brick road, and then you suddenly turn to the right, or you don't really know to turn to the right. You look to the right and you see that gate, and right through there, you see the white Taj Mahal. Mm-hmm. And it looks like a postcard and it looks absolutely surreal.
Yes.
In a coaching session, that same thing sometimes happens. You turn or something happens and you kind of suddenly see this and you go, oh my God, I get it. I know exactly how to now help this person, this individual, to walk them down, that they can actually see that same picture what I'm seeing just now. And that is again, that perspective shift. That is that gentleness which is required, but sometimes also in the right moments that hit on the forehead. Mm-hmm. And not being afraid of going down that road, because it's a little bit like when you know, there's this thing, a lot of entrepreneurs, they dig for gold, and right before they hit the gold, the artery of the real gold, they get tired, right? I always quote Richard Branson. I believe the number is 172 or 173. I think it's 173. That's how many banks he had to visit before he got a yes to get his first financing for Virgin.
Mm.
Most of us would give up at probably, I don't know, 20, maybe 30. Yeah. I mean, certainly not 170.
No, definitely not.
But that is pervasiveness and persistence. And I think in my work, you got to have gentleness, pervasiveness, but also clarity where you're going. And so to answer your question, one of the most memorable conversations, and we didn't get to work together actually afterwards, but one of the most fascinating conversations I had was with somebody who, on a billionaire level, chairman of an organization, multiple exits. I mean, incredible, incredible human being. We were sitting in a hotel that I had flown to. And it was a very superficial conversation initially. Mm-hmm. But after probably, and we sat there for probably about 2 hours, 2.5 hours. And after about an hour and 20, hour and 30, it was not quite an hour and 30 minutes, we finally got to the core, which was loneliness, being alone, feeling alone, nobody to talk to. And I have a guy in his late 60s sitting with me in a hotel lobby crying. And I'm not saying this, oh, wow, look at me, I made him cry. That's not what it's about. But it's about that shell that we all carry. It's about that image manager we all carry, that protectionism, that protective shield we all carry, where oftentimes when we don't have anybody to talk to, where we don't have anybody to relate to in a confidential or in a contextual relevant manner, so to speak, we just don't know where to go with that. But when then suddenly that goes away and that opens up and there is, you know, trust, there is, and trust, I think I'm a human being. I give people trust. I'm not, oh, you got to work for my trust for the next 5 years and then maybe I'll give you trust. No, I believe, even history says different, but I believe not my history, but like history says different in all the various eras of humanity. I believe in the good in people. And I believe that inherently people want to do good to other people. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I operate. I enter into relationships. Mm-hmm. And, oftentimes through our life experience or through our distortions we experience or simple shifts in perspective, we forget that piece. But when we then see it and somebody relates to us on that level, suddenly the floodgates open in all kinds of ways of that's emotional. And our bodies know, right? It's like when you go home into your house, what hopefully happens is you have this feeling of, oh, And what that is it's a chemical reaction in your body. That's serotonin. That's the same thing with kindness. I mean, kindness and compassion are very closely related, and that's all about oxytocin versus that rush, that immediacy of send me the text message back, or something happens in sports, or I work out. Well, that's a dopamine rush. That's like a drug addict. Nothing wrong with that at certain times. I'm not saying drugs, but that rush that we seek, because in sports and in competitive sports, cycling or whatever it may be. But when we really understand chemistry of our body in the context of how do I feel when a particular chemistry hits my body, predominantly oxytocin and serotonin, well, what does that mean? What is the environment I'm in? Right? So sometimes I mean, it's a very easy way to ask employees, well, when you walk into so-and-so's office, how do you feel? Well, I don't know. What do you mean? Well, do you feel like tight? Does it feel in your elbows right here where it comes down, your arms a little bit? Does it feel like you're going into a boxing match? Yeah, most of the times I feel that way. Interesting. So you feel anxiety, you feel fear. Oh, wow, I never thought about it this way. Then that person goes on vacation. Do you still feel the same way? Wow, I actually feel I have room to breathe. Interesting. Okay. So no, but it happens all the time. And these are the conversations where when you start clicking into that and you start asking people the questions and you become this little beagle who doesn't let go and you just hold on to them and you keep going, okay, give me more, give me more, give me more, and you pull back, you give me more, give me more, give me more, and you don't let go in a supportive, gentle, compassionate, empathetic way, well, suddenly that Taj Mahal moment happens. Where you kind of come around the corner and you go, holy shit, I had no idea. And that is the seed to then think more, pursue more, and just again, that's that opening for transformation initially.
But as a human, we are all programmed to be not so fragile, or let's say, basically you want to remain tight, you don't want to show you are vulnerable to anything, right? So from the leadership perspective, they always want to remain tight. They want to show themselves, not being vulnerable to their subordinates. And I guess that's where I think they are stuck, most of the times I think they are not able to decide, because should they remain in that sort of role of remaining tight and remaining that person who has that sense of responsibility, or just as a power, a symbolic power or something, how do you really approach those individuals, right? So I'm looking at those individuals and I see day in and day out, they're always the same. They don't really crack,
I don't think it's about cracking. I think it's about, I think everybody has their own story, right? And I think there is, we talked about conformity, and there's the one thing we have to remind ourselves is there's a generational conflict, and there's five generations currently in the workforce. There are no doubt, if we talk about the traditionalists and we talk about, boomers are traditionalists still. That's a generation which, as you call it, tight. There's a certain sternness about them. There's a certain behavior about them. There's a certain unrelatability almost about them, and a certain the magic shield around this is pretty tight. And there's sometimes various reasons, because obviously they grew up with a generation. Everybody has become the person they are because it was a generational pass down. That's about your parents that way. Your parents, there's a reason why your mother became who your mother is. There's a reason why your father is who your father is. And we need to find, I think, in the way we pursue our own life and our own pathways, we need to find a lot of forgiveness sometimes. And we need to find ways to say, okay, what is my mission in life and what I want my mission and impact in life to be? And in that context, then sometimes we have to reassess those things, because in the end, when we think about leadership as a movement, and leadership is not, I'm telling you what to do, that's management. Mm-hmm. But if we think in leadership as a movement in the context of how many politicians there are, and there's a shit ton of them, but there's not a lot of statesmen, right? If we think of great leaders in the context of statesmen, and we apply that same matrix into a company, well, suddenly there's a lot of great managers, but not a lot of great leaders. Mm-hmm. So softness, delegation, understanding, compassion, empathy, those are all qualities. If you want to be a great leader, you better fucking get on board on learning that. Because if you don't, you may be a great messenger off management instructions. You may be a great helicopter manager, whatever else you want to call yourself, but you're not going to be a great leader. And I say this in the greatest respect to everybody who's listening to this and everybody who's saying, what the hell does this guy know? I know, because I am, sometimes as a joke, I call myself a recovering narcissist. And everybody has narcissistic traits. Mm-hmm. But it's not about me, 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 me. Guess what? Who makes you successful? Take your little pyramid off your organization and turn it on its head, because the people who actually do the work are the people at the front lines. And that's the people you got to serve and support. Leadership is all about service and supporting. So to your question, how do you approach these people? Is, you know, the innovation is all about collection of facts. And then it's about the what, when statements. Right? Here's where we are. When we do this, this is the possibilities. And sometimes it takes that with individuals to change that. And even if they're high performing individuals, let's not forget, if we're taking the Fortune 50 companies from 50 years ago, I think there's only two or three of them left. Mm-hmm. Right? Evolution of times and evolution of business. I mean, let's just look at banking for a second. I'm sure you've heard about this whole thing with GameStop, what just happened. There's things in the world that we don't really 100% understand, but we do know there's evolution happening. If we as human beings don't adjust, and we're probably the most, when you think about from a Darwinism coming and how, you know, this all happened, and going back to that, kindness was really used as my life insurance, right? That was the thinking behind it, kindness, from a neuroscientific and from a neuroplasticity standpoint. The reason I was kind to you, so that next time when you see me, you're not going to kill me. So the paying it forward is a great intention, but let's really look at the context of it. So again, at the core being survival, survival, and survival. And so that's where I think also as we approach people who are, you know, unpenetrable in their shield. Mm-hmm. And that's the way they come across. Sometimes people over a course of time, they get hardened. It comes out of their life experience. And the only invitation I would give, and I think everybody obviously is an individual, and everybody has, you know, different reasons why they are and how they became who they are. But I think, you know, if we meet each other with more kindness and empathy, I think that is a door opener. And as long as curiosity is in that, not judgment, I think that's a big, big factor that needs to play into that as well. And as long as we protect that piece, I think there's a lot of conversations and dialogue we can have.
Interesting.
And I didn't really answer your question saying, well, this is what we're going to do with this individual. So,
yeah.
Because there is just no one size fits all.
Yeah.
I think it's situative. I think it's the only part of a conversation I have influence on. Well, I have influence on you, but the only part of action I can really manage absolutely clear is me. Mm-hmm. How you react to it or act upon it, that's your choice. And that gives me then, you know, that changes the chessboard every single time that we play. And are there some moves which are probably easier predicted than others? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's good FBI negotiation. That's how it all works, right? Yeah. Ask a question at the right moment, don't say anything, pause, and just let there be emptiness in the room for about a minute, and that'll destroy everybody who doesn't want to talk. And so, yes, there's techniques. Yes, there's ways to frame certain things. Nevertheless, individualism still wins. Mm-hmm.